It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. It's good to be with you this evening. Well, we are into the heart of the second Trump administration, and the Democrats' peaceful transition of power continues in so many ways, not the least of which is the burning of Teslas and Tesla dealers and harassment of Tesla owners. Less than 6 months ago, the left scolded you for not driving an electric car because it meant you didn't care about the destruction of the planet through climate change. Now they don't seem to care about climate change anymore, which means they never really did. It was just bumpkin for the masses, a narrative created as a Trojan horse through which the government would exert further and further control of our lives. The violence is egged on by Democrat leaders like Governor Tim Walz, who gleefully reports the shrinking of Tesla stock, even though his own state of Minnesota has a lot of its retirement tied up in Tesla stock. And how about Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett? What a class act. She says her birthday's coming up, and on her birthday, all she wants is to see Elon Musk taken down. What a noble, unselfish wish. Never mind flowers. Don't bother with candy. Just get Elon Musk. She says that while people are burning Teslas. So she knows people are going to take it that way, even though she denies that she wants any violence. Such a credit to Congress. Brings a tear to my eye. These are the people who give sanctimonious lectures about January 6th, who called January 6th the greatest threat to democracy since the Civil War. Oh, but the destruction of Tesla property, well, that's nothing but free speech. You believe in free speech, don't you? Just as the so-called peaceful summer of love was only free speech. Something we needed to accept. According to Kamala, the Mamala, people were killed, police were targeted and injured, businesses burnt down, federal buildings burnt down. What building was burnt down on January 6th? Who was killed on January 6th except Ashley Babbitt, one of the protesters, killed by a policeman? And lest we forget, President Trump offered to bring in the National Guard that day ahead of time to keep things from getting out of hand. His offer was refused because Democrats wanted the optics. That way, Democrats could talk for 4 years about how Trump would not accept a peaceful transfer of power. Well, now Trump won again. How do you like the Democrat peaceful transfer of power so far? Their lawfare trying to put him in jail before the election didn't work. Their attempt to get him off the ballot didn't work. The assassin's bullet inspired by descriptions of Trump as Hitler didn't work. So now, once again, as with the Russia hoax, as with impeachments, they need to sabotage his administration in real time. And fanning the flames of violence is not the only tool in their arsenal. Schumer shamelessly admits the shopping for liberal federal district judges. He brags about it. He revels in it. The left keeps calling the Trump administration an oligarchy. Oligarchy means rule by only a few. It's like a dictatorship with more than one dictator. But Trump is our duly elected president who won with a landslide and a public mandate. Let me tell you who didn't get elected. Let me point out the real oligarchy: judges. Yes, the judiciary is in the Constitution, but not as a maker of law. It had limited power. It was never meant to be a holy papal-like pronouncement. Courts can err and often do. To anyone who thinks the court has a perfect, exclusive, authoritative, unchecked understanding of our Constitution, I have just three words for you: Dred Scott decision, where the Supreme Court ruled that African slaves were property. Still hold that court as a supreme authority? News flash. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. Nowhere It's not in there. The purpose of the Supreme Court is not to interpret the Constitution. The purpose of the Supreme Court is to enforce the Constitution along with the executive branch. They're the muscle. The court gives the sentence. Examples of their original intent had to do with settling disputes about land, being the highest court should one be charged with a crime. Yes, that can include looking at a new proposed law and making sure it does not violate the Constitution, but it needs to be settled according to what the words of the Constitution actually say, not some special meaning read between the lines, which is what is meant today when people call the Constitution a living, breathing document. You know who first coined that phrase? President Woodrow Wilson, a socialist who believed, for all intents and purposes, that our Constitution was a thing of the past. Well, yeah, the Constitution is a living, breathing document in the sense that it can be amended by the people. It is not living in the sense that judges have the authority to extract some new application and meaning because times have changed. So let's look at what some of our original founding fathers said about the Supreme Court. Some of these founders who wrote the Constitution and who also wrote about their intent behind the document in a commentary called the Federalist Papers. By the way, the Federalist Papers were written for average New York upstate farmers. So much for the idea that you have to go to law school to understand the Constitution. James Madison, one of the architects of the Constitution, in fact, the chief architect, he says in the Federalist Papers, legislative authority necessarily predominates. He's talking about the legislative branch as being the predominant branch. Madison did talk about judicial review, and he said, I beg to know upon what principle it can be contended that any one department draws from the Constitution greater powers than another in marking out constitutionality. How about Alexander Hamilton? He's a big hero with the left now with the musical Hamilton. Well, let's look at what the real Hamilton said in the Federalist Papers. He said the judiciary was the weakest of the three branches, and he said there was nothing to fear from the judiciary as long as it remains distinct from the other two branches. No influence over the sword, meaning executive, or the purse, meaning legislative. Their opinions are called opinions for a reason, folks. That's why Andrew Jackson famously felt free to ignore it when the Supreme Court gave him an order. And the country was just fine. It went along just fine. By the way, as you know, President Trump said that this judge who's trying to stop him from deporting murderers who came into our country illegally should be impeached. Chief Justice Roberts, always ready to protect the integrity of the court, rebuked him and said impeachment is not a proper procedure for the judiciary. Well, you'd think a chief justice would know a little better than that because it says in the Constitution that judges can be impeached. Do they use that word? Well, the word impeach is used in other parts of the Constitution. It's not used in Article 3, but let me tell you what Article 3 says. It says it's establishing the Supreme Court, and they said nothing about it being a lifetime appointment. It says they hold offices during good behavior. How long does a Supreme Court justice stay in office? As long as it's good behavior. What if there's no longer any good behavior? Then he can be removed. So the word impeached isn't there, but it's very implied. And an order contradicting an act of Congress was considered cause for a judge's impeachment. Hamilton called impeachment the bridle of the Congress over the courts. Now, a little bit of history, and I've gone over it on this program before, but gee, the times we're living in, we probably couldn't go through it enough times. The interpretation tradition began when Thomas Jefferson refused to install some chief justices that John Adams had appointed before he left office. Since the judges were never inaugurated, Jefferson didn't feel obligated to use them. His government was sued in this landmark case called Marbury versus Madison. Since nothing like this had ever come up, they turned to the Supreme Court. Now, originally, interestingly enough, the court ordered Jefferson to install the justices. Jefferson ignored them and slept well that night. Marbury continued pressing. He referred to what was called the Judiciary Act of 1789 as a basis for the court being able to give such commands. Ironically, the court then made a different decision, the Supreme Court. It decided that such an act from Congress was unconstitutional because it gave the court more power than the Constitution intended. They felt that they should have started with lower courts before they got to the Supreme Court. So even though they were sympathetic to Marbury, and even though they originally sided with Marbury, they ultimately ruled against him by calling that act of Congress he referred to unconstitutional. But in calling an act of Congress unconstitutional, it established a tradition about the Supreme Court telling us what the Constitution intended. Gotta see the irony. Now, here's the thing. Jefferson disagreed with the court's newfound powers, even though in his instance, it meant he did not have to appoint the justices. He got his way, but he still had enough objectivity to say that this view of judicial power, if accepted, would be, quote unquote, placing us under the despotism of an oligarchy. Sound like a familiar word? Oligarchy. Unfortunately, this began a tradition about the Supreme Court that we never quite shook. Flash forward to a more recent case, DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. The law was passed by the House, passed by the Senate, signed into law by President Bill Clinton, and the Supreme Court overturned it. My friends, two branches of government together overturned by one branch. That should not be. The Constitution does not give the Supreme Court this authority, but because of a case called Marbury versus Madison, a precedent developed, and in the passage of time, Congress made things worse. They passed additional laws about judicial review for lower federal courts, the most significant being the Judiciary Act of 1891. As the nation expanded during the aftermath of the Civil War, litigation between states increased. This was starting to overwhelm the Supreme Court. And in order to ease the strain, Congress in 1891 created the Circuit Courts of Appeal, which could hear many of the cases that in the past would have gone directly to the Supreme Court. Now the highest court could just select the cases it wanted. This, once again, was called the Judiciary Act of 1891. It birthed a process not found in the Constitution. But the Constitution does allow Congress to make laws, and Congress made us. Stupid law. And there's nothing in the Constitution that says they can't make stupid laws. Unfortunately, Congress established judicial review. They didn't have to. They shouldn't have. They could rescind it. But if they do, guess what will happen? The law will be overturned by judicial review. It's too bad we didn't have these judges in the days of Christ. They might have ruled that his resurrection was unconstitutional. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook or questions@bobsiegel.net. When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel, joined again, and it's always a pleasure, by columnist Mike Friedenberg.
Well, Bob, thanks for having me once again. And in the true spirit of what we've discussed in the past, another slow news week.
And always a slow news week with Donald Trump.
It is. And this is the slowest, you know, the slowest period of time we've been discussing in recent history, I think.
Yes.
Wow. Bob, that was an excellent overview. Thanks.
Oh,
that was
thank
great.
You.
Thank
you.
It was
thank
very
you, Mike.
Good. A few interesting little facts. There's 679 district court judges.
Man.
And out of that, 379 of them, or 384, excuse me, are Democrat appointed.
And somehow they're the ones they always
and
find.
And 257 are Republican appointed.
Well, they go judge shopping.
And they go judge shopping.
Yeah.
So with that many
and
judges
that
out there,
be.
And they can judge shop, and all they have to do is get one of these judges, some of them are very wacky, to this nationwide injunction. Now, let's talk about the nationwide injunctions. It never used to happen. They never used to do it.
They're supposed to have jurisdiction over their area, not
well,
the whole country.
It was just assumed. It was presumed.
And certainly not over foreign
policy. They literally have a geographic area that are assigned, and the assumption was, but then there was a few nationwide injunctions issued by district courts under George Bush. Then Barack Obama faced 12 of them. Then it bumped up to 64 nationwide injunctions by district courts under Donald Trump, his first term. And he's already passed 12. I found this. I think it's already passed 12, but the source I said 12. So what's happened is they first tried it out and they got away with it.
They're being emboldened.
They got it bolder and bolder. And of course, during the Democrat period, now see, this is one of the problems with this. It's asymmetric warfare. It's wrong, but the activist mindset, the judicial activism, the Constitution or the law is a living, breathing document, that's the Democratly held view.
Well, yeah, and which judge told Biden that he had to check with them before he could let people into the country illegally? But Trump ships them out legally. I'm telling you, Mike, it's emboldening them so much. We're going to have a judge tell Trump, you're not allowed to bomb Iran's nuclear facility without checking with me first. You just watch. That's what we're going to see.
So they become emboldened, but it is asymmetric because the Republican judicial conservative judges that the Republicans approve actually don't believe in doing this kind of stuff. So they don't do it. So the only people that do it, it's just like we've seen at the Supreme Court, only when the Supreme Court was controlled by the left, they made all sorts of wacky decisions. But when it's controlled by conservatives, they're so conservative.
And yet there was cause to do it when Biden was letting a floodgate of people into the country illegally. That would have been one time where they could have stepped in without any interpretation and just read what the Constitution literally said. They could have done that.
But that's
if
really
they had some brass.
Yeah, but still, that's up to the executive.
Well, I keep hearing one conservative after another saying, don't worry, this will all get overturned at the Supreme Court. First of all, the Supreme Court just a month ago had a chance to put a leash on these district judges. Two of them, Barrett and Roberts, wouldn't do it. The other four conservative justices would have. I don't trust Roberts any farther than I can throw. I know they've done some good things. I know they overturned abortion. I'm not saying it won't happen. They might do the right thing, but I would give it a 50-50 shot because that's been their average, 50-50. I'm not confident that they're going to overturn this.
I'm not super confident.
I hope I'm wrong, but I'm not confident.
I'm not super confident, but Bob, I will give it a 51-49.
Okay, there you go.
I feel a little bit better than that. But you're right to not be confident because Roberts does have his finger in the air.
I will say this. Judges shouldn't have their finger in the air, but if his finger's really in the air, the air is on Trump's side,
that's
so
true.
Maybe, ironically, that'll make
but
a difference.
But the air he's talking about is the social circuit.
The social circles, the boys in the club that'll pat him on the back.
But going back to this idea of, you know, how judges have accrued power, every judge that serves in the court now, young and old, has grown up in a world where they were attorneys and they aspired to become judges. And the environment they aspired to become judges in was an environment where judges do have this power.
Well, and in law school, case law is studied more than anything else. When you defend something, you're always referring back to so-and-so versus so-and-so, versus the Board of Education.
Everybody that comes up through there, everybody sitting in that Supreme Court has been indoctrinated. And the reason they wanted to be a judge, a lot of them, is because they do have the power.
They do want the power.
They have the power, and they've had it. So it's hard to imagine any court giving that.
The precedent case that changed it all, Marbury versus Biden, it was so early in our country's history that it practically goes back to the beginning of our country. So I can understand why people think that's in the Constitution, but it's not.
So the Article 3, so basically it was the Judiciary Act of 1789 that set up the
1789 set up the Article 3 in the Constitution, or went concurrently with it.
Well, it
spelled out more what the powers of the judges were back then. The number was 5, that became 9 later. But then the Judiciary Act of 1891 was the one years later that started giving the lower federal judges more power.
Well, what I understood is that 1789 would set up district courts and circuit courts, but then the Judiciary Act of 1891 set up the U.S. Court of Appeals.
Yes. We did have lower courts before. That was what Marbury was all about. Right. The Supreme Court there said you should have started with a lower court, but they were given far more teeth in that other Judiciary Act.
So it's interesting. I've listened to a lot of press conferences and a lot of spokespeople for President Trump, of course, Karen Leavitt, and they're being very, very respectful to the courts. I'm just saying they generally are. Every liberal reporter at every press conference, no, are you going to abide by the orders of the judge? Well, we are going to comply with the orders of the judge, but we're confident we're going to win. I believe that they are really counting on of appellate and Supreme Court to come through.
I'm sure they are, but you know what? I think the day's going to come where he's going to have to do like Jackson.
Yeah, we'll have to see, because right now we have a massive federal government that's like 80-90% Democrat employees. So I'm not real confident of President Trump defying the Supreme Court and having the support to do it.
I'm just saying I think somebody's going to have to do something.
Somebody has to
I
do
don't
it.
Trust Roberts to do it.
No, so. I don't. But anyway, so yes. Yeah, so
it would be nice if it happened that way. If the Supreme Court did its job and reined them in, obviously that's the way we would all like for it to happen. But if not, something needs
to
happen.
And they need to expedite, because it is creating a constitutional crisis.
Yeah.
And it's the constitutional crisis is not created by President Trump. It's created by these lawless judges. And they are lawless. When they do this kind of stuff, they're being lawless.
They're egotistical. They're narcissistic. They have a thirst for power. They're drunk with power.
Yeah, it is a disaster there. I mean, what more can we say? I do really hope that it will be shut down. I hope that they'll take a few cases that set some broad standards that you can look at and say, yeah, when you're trying to do this sort of thing, and maybe what they need to do is talk about going back to the legislation, bring the legislation back up and just, at the bare minimum, say district courts can do injunctions on their physical geography, which they're in. The appellate courts, which cover, the 13 courts, they can only do that in the districts they're in. Now, there'd have to be an exception for the District Court of D.C.
Well, the problem is they'll have to change that Judiciary Act, because
right, that's what I'm saying.
It's given to take strain off the Supreme Court.
Right, well, that's what I'm saying. They have to do these. They have to go back and modify the act, because they never conceived. They did not conceive. And here's the thing is, it's when you have the Supreme Court able to overrule a combined piece of legislation like DOMA, by the president, signed by the president and the Congress, then it's not an equal branch. It's a preeminent branch.
Exactly.
It's not equal anymore. That is beyond equal.
And frankly, Congress has shot itself in the foot with this filibuster, because the Republicans can't overturn that without getting 60 votes. And they would have to do the nuclear option and get rid of the filibuster. And I just don't think they're going to do that.
Yeah, and I have mixed feelings on that. I mean, I do agree with you when you say that the Democrats will get rid of it.
The Republicans are always saying, well, we wouldn't want them to do that to us. But Schumer made it very clear that he was going to do that. Problem is, he lost the election.
Yeah.
So the Republicans may as well do it. I think it's a stupid rule, the filibuster.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's just there. I do have to say that there's a lot of really good things happening right now, even with all these judges. Lots of really good things are happening, but it's real easy to focus on these annoying, obnoxious.
Well, Trump's doing judges. So much, he isn't giving the judges much time to catch up, but they will catch up.
Well, they're trying to catch up, but the border is shut down.
The border is shut down, but the thing about transgenders in the military has already been overturned.
And one of his other promises, which wasn't probably what got him elected, but he did talk about it a decent amount, and that was to end the war in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And that's a topic I do want to, talk about a bit here tonight, because it's in the news. And by way of introduction, this is a war that never should have happened.
Well, it happened because of our disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan under Biden. Putin would never have attacked the Ukraine if it hadn't been for that.
That is a popular narrative, and it's one that Trump says. I don't quite agree with it. I do think they did, because here's the thing is Trump, he at a conference, was with a businessman at dinner, he said something that's profound. He was talking about Biden. He said, Biden, that crazy person, is pushing Russia into a war by telling Ukraine they're going to be in NATO. He said, I never would have done that.
Okay, he made things worse. All right, we'll be right back. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Bob Siegel's novels may start out looking like typical stories, but in no time at all, they go directions you would never have dreamed about. Just listen to the premise of Bob Siegel's unusual story, Choice of the Lorelei. Martha Flannery, an aggressive missionary, sets out for the Frisian Islands to convert the newly discovered tribe called Reinu. Here she enters into a strong battle of wills with Dr. Connors, a cultural anthropologist who wants to protect the Reinu people from outside influence, especially evangelism. Connors' strange manners and obsession with the Reinu are only the first of several eerie mysteries, including previous visitors to the island who never returned home, and an elderly gentleman claiming to be 4,000 years old. Choice of the Lorelei, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show, and say hello again to Mike Friedenberg.
Well, Bob, as I was mentioning, just is that I believe that that answer is correct, that Putin would have gone in. But it's not because he's afraid of Trump or the United States. It's because Trump understood the red line. And in 2008, the red line was laid out, and that was basically Ukraine and Georgia becoming part of NATO. And Putin already went to war in Georgia over that, the Georgia conflict.
Yeah, but even if it was just in terms of sanctions, don't you think he had a lot more to fear from Trump than from Biden?
Potentially. Listen, you're getting the cart before the horse here. Trump would not have put Putin in the position he had put him in. Biden put Putin in this horrible situation by pushing forward to integrate Ukraine into NATO. And Trump, after he was out of office, speaking said this was an idiot. He would never have done that because he understood that was a red line. Now, he would have built up Ukraine so it could defend itself, but he wouldn't have pushed for the NATO thing. And I honestly believe the reason Russia and Putin do not want Ukraine to be part of NATO, that's not just words, they don't want to be part of NATO. They also, they're not going to get all they want. But that was one of the main reasons. So that, to me, that's the number one reason. Because right now, you know, we've had 20-something thousand sanctions in place. I'm not sure a few more sanctions are going to do anything more. They all predicted the sanctions would cripple the Russian economy. Russian economy has been growing faster than the United States since the sanctions went into place, faster than Europe. So the sanctions have not worked. I mean, and that would be a long-term process if they did manage to work. Meanwhile, every day, hundreds of young men and not so young men, they've had to start drafting older and older men, are dying. In December of 2023, I did an article on the real number of casualties, and I looked at some figures by Colonel Douglas MacGregor, who is the commander of the war in Yugoslavia, Kosovo, that whole thing, the coalition commander. And at that time, he was estimating 400,000 Ukrainians killed in action. Those numbers are completely out of the media, out of the press. What you're hearing about the war is 80% lies, and the other 20% is propaganda. Right now, I'm estimating the casualty ratio is 4 to 5 to 1 Ukrainians for every Russian. And why wouldn't that be the case? Russia, it's acknowledged, they have 8 to 9 times the artillery. They have something like 20 to 1 an advantage in air power.
So Putin's not in a position where he feels he needs make a deal.
No, he does not in a position he needs to make a deal. The Russian military has gotten tremendously more powerful over the last 4 years. And right now, the Russian army, by far and away, is the most powerful land army in the world.
Well, and what's with Zelensky? He seems like right now, because they're in war, they're under martial law. They can't elect a new president. He's closed down voting. He's closed down freedom of speech. The guy's just a dictator. Why is he viewed as some kind of hero? Don't get me wrong. I have no love for Putin either. But it just seems like there's a lot of fault on both sides of this war.
The sad thing is when your countries fight existential wars, civil rights suffer badly. Russia, once it got involved with the war, they had sort of been making progress towards, stumbling progress toward becoming more democratic. But once, you know, the conflict started around 2014 period, they stumbled. They stopped that progress.
Well, it happens. And even in our Civil War, Lincoln suspended habeas
corpus.
World War II.
We had a lot of
things that were... We had the internment camps, which is the law Trump's trying to use right now.
We had other lot of free speech violations, too. The free speech was severely curtailed during World War II.
It happens.
So it does. So I want to give that acknowledgement. It's tough when you're fighting a war. However, he did outlaw all the major opposition powers. He shut down the press. He's been persecuting the Orthodox Church there. So it's really not a great example of a democracy now. But I want to talk a little bit about is the political situation in Ukraine, because it's very important to understand. And by the way, for the listeners here, if you do follow this all, I encourage you to look at a map. If you just hear about things, but when you look at maps, you start to understand some of the things even better. But 2010, he had a very big election in Ukraine, and it pitted the Party of Regions against the Fatherland Party. The Party of Regions was a pro-Russian, basically their things. We want to maintain strong relations with Russia. We're proud of our Russian heritage and culture.
And the Fatherland is the Nazis, right?
Well, the Fatherland was not a Nazi party.
The Nazis are always saying, it's a Fatherland.
But it was an extreme nationalist party in which the neo-Nazis were part of it.
So okay, but they were
a minority. Right. However, they were influential. They were the muscle of the party. Okay. They were the ones, the thugs that would come and do stuff. Okay, so that election took place, and it showed the divisions in the country. Eastern Ukraine, like Luhansk, 90% of the people in the province of Donetsk voted for the Party of Regions, and about 90% also in Crimea. So there's a real sharp divide between East Ukraine and Western Ukraine. And the Eastern Ukrainians are saying, hey, I have cousins living in Russia. I speak Russian. It'd be like, imagine if the British Canadians said, tomorrow we're going to outlaw French in Canada. We're going to force you to speak English. You're going to be taught English in the schools, everything like that. Well, that's what the Ukrainian Nationalist Party, the Fatherland Party, was trying to do. There was a lot of anti-Russian bigotry being practiced against Russian Ukrainians. So this was the situation. And the election was basically saying, hey, are we going to put somebody in here that supports having some regional autonomy? Most of the people still want to be part of Ukraine, but they want to be, have free to practice their language and their Russian heritages. And they won by a few points. Now, this election was certified by the OSCE, the international authority. Like 3,000 observers observed the election, said it was transparent and it was a fair election, unlike the 2006 election, which a lot of corruption was around. And that's when the Fatherland Party won. So they win. Then you get to 2014, and Yanukovych, the president there, is moving toward us doing some loans and some guarantees of doing some corruption, fixing some corruption there to be more closely tied with the European Union. And Putin comes out and says, well, you can do that, but we're going to go ahead and give you much better terms from Russia. It will forgive these loans. We'll give you cheaper gas and things like that. He said, you know, that sounds like a good deal. Well, that created a lot of angst from the Western Ukrainians who wanted to go stronger ties to Western Europe. But the Eastern Ukrainians had voted for this guy. So then the protests started. And by the way, the United States was heavily involved in promoting these protests. The protests got violence. They raided armories. And at the head of these protests was the neo-Nazis. So Yanukovych had to flee the country for fear of his life. And it was a violent overthrow of a certified democracy. Yes, the democracy was modestly pro-repression, but here, you know, just imagine, Russia is actually trying to influence what's happening in a country that it shares the longest border with. And here's the United States, 3,000, 4,000 miles away, right? Involved with the election there. So that's what happened. They overthrew it. And Donetsk and Luhansk, both these provinces had voted 90% for the Party of Regions. The Party of Regions was saying, hey, allow us to, you know, to keep some autonomy, allow us to keep our cultural traditions, things like that. We're still going to be part of Ukraine, but just allow us to do that. That was the Party of Regions. So they were really angry. Then there was a massacre where some of the neo-Nazis, the Azov Brigade, slaughtered 50 people in a place. So this seceded. Right from the beginning, this is a civil war. Starting in 2014, there was a civil war. They seceded. Remember, so the war didn't start in 2022. It started in 2014. Russia, of course, was supporting Luhansk and Donetsk. And Russia, at the same time, did annex Crimea. They did not want NATO setting up ships in the Crimean port. Very understandably from a national security perspective. But the polling is done since then. And even the people that don't like to admit, Crimeans wanted to be part of Russia. In fact, Crimea had been part of Russia for 200 years before, about 54 years ago now. Moscow, the Moscow leaderships, because one of the Ukrainian leaders at the time had been had done a particularly good job. They said, hey, we're going to give you administrative authority over Crimea. That was under the Soviet Union. So it was the Moscow leadership out of Russia that gave the administrative authority to Ukraine in the first Crimea. 50 years later, you know, the Crimea came back. So in terms of historical things right now, Crimea is much more Russian than it ever was Ukrainian. That's a fact. But Putin did not want Donetsk and Luhansk. They seceded from Ukraine in 2014, and they're begging, Russia, please take us in. We want to be part of the Russia. We want to be part of Russia. And Putin said, no, I'm not going to do that. I want to negotiate in good faith with France and Germany and Ukraine with what's something called the Minsk agreements. And the Minsk agreements would have set up allowing them to maintain their regional autonomy like they'd asked for. You know, they would have put that in law for them. They would have stayed part of Ukraine. And also part of the Minsk agreements was also, hey, you're not going to be part of NATO. That was part of it. Well, it turns out that Helmut Kohl and the Prime Minister of France at the time, they both now admit that they never had any intention of getting these Minsk agreements in place. It was all stalling tactics to allow Ukraine to build its military up. Because in 2014, Ukraine's military was almost nothing. Russia could have easily just rolled in and taken those provinces and Ukraine died. But 8 years later, with U.S. support, European support, you know, Trump gave them the anti-tank weapons. You remember how he's bragging, I'm giving them real weapons, and Obama's right. Just giving them pillows?
Right,
and,
right.
Okay, so they built up the military. So in early March, late February, Ukraine had 130,000 troops on the line of contact. This is the battle lines between the seceded republics, Luhansk and Donetsk, and the Ukrainian forces. They had built up the forces, 130,000. They're ready to roll in there and crush and bring the provinces back under control forcibly. That's when Russia invaded to take the pressure off that. They had to then quickly withdraw those forces to protect Kiev. That's never talked about. Nobody talks about the 130,000 troops that were built ready to crush Kiev, to crush Luhansk and Donetsk. So I'm going to say what you hear in the media is mostly false or ignores, or there's a plenty of lies of omission when it comes down to if there's plenty of what you call lies of omission as opposed to lies commission. So back to the tragedy of this, because in late February, March, they had an agreement in place that would have ended the war. Ukraine would have kept Donetsk and Luhansk. It would not have kept Crimea. That was off the table. But it would have kept those two provinces. And we would not have had 600,000 or 700,000 killed in action. And Boris Johnson goes over there and 100% certain in my mind, he had full authority from the Biden administration, tells Zelensky, tell the Russians to take a dive. You don't need to do the agreement with Russia. You can beat Russia. So they tear up the agreement and they go to war with Russia. And now here we are 3 years later and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of dead. They have almost 100,000 paraplegics in Ukraine because of this war. Brutal, the most brutal war we've seen since World War I. I mean, it's unbelievable how nasty it is. So every day that this war continues, more Russian men and more Ukrainian men die, and some more civilians die. By the way, the civilian casualties are actually relatively low, given the amount of weaponry that's been thrown back and forth. By the way, up through 2022, it was Ukraine was killing the most civilians. After 2022, Russia took the lead, and it was simply based upon the amount of strikes. The more strikes you do into a target, well, I'll talk about it but when we get back here, but talk about the civilian casualties.
Okay. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Jesus said that his people should be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Some churches take that mandate seriously, others sadly do not. I am happy to announce that there are many good, serious churches in San Diego, and Skyline is certainly one of them. Outreaches to the community and the world at large are carried on by our missionary family. Their ministries to the poor, the shut-ins, and the emotionally scarred. There are groups and classes for all ages, from children to middle school to high school, college, young adult, and senior citizen. Skyline is also on the cutting edge of today's social issues. We mobilize people and help them to be a better voice for the changing culture around us.
Skyline Church.
Welcome back again to 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. Say hello again to columnist Mike Friedenberg.
So the number of people that are dying over there is absolutely atrocious. And a number of months ago, before he was elected, President Trump said, I want to stop the dying. And I truly believe he does want to stop the dying, because every day this war goes, Russia's taking more territory. Now, to take the territory, it's losing its men to do so. And Putin, you know, people say he's a dictator. No, he's not a dictator. He is a strong man. He has a lot of power, but that power can disappear. If he were to just sit there and suddenly say, you've lost, I think Russia's probably lost, my best estimate is between 120 and 130,000 killed in action, plus several hundred thousand more casualties. That's double what we lost in Vietnam. So this has been brutal for Russia as well. I mean, this has been an awful war on all sides. So Putin's not going to just suddenly go, hey, all the territory we just, you know, grinded out through this brutal, horrible, you can have it back. They're taking the territory each and every day. They're taking the territory. So Ukraine's negotiating position gets weaker and weaker, and so does Trump's. That's the fact. The longer this war goes, so it's in everybody's interest to stop the dying and to get an agreement in place quickly. And the thing is, Russia is in the driver's seat. You can talk all you want. They now have the most powerful land army in the world. Overall, the U.S. military, when you put the Air Force and the Navy, I still give U.S. military an edge. But on the land army, they have the biggest, most experienced, and they're a very sophisticated army. They lead the world in electronic warfare. Number one, ahead of the United States, head of China, head of everybody else. So Europe's not going to fight Russia. Now, they're not as big and powerful as they were at the height of the Soviet Union, let's say 1987 or something like that. So we want the war to end. And by the way, when the war ends, Putin's going to have lost in a certain sense. Let me explain that. What Putin really wanted was he wanted Ukraine to be a country that was friendly to Russia. That's what he wanted. One that was at least somewhat friendly. And what he had in Ukraine prior to the war was almost a 50-50 split of folks. And it could go either way. You might elect some government that was more pro being part of Western Europe, you know, less friendly to Russia. But the next time you might elect a government more friendly to Russia. It was going back and forth. And that was the situation prior to the war. Now, what happened is when Luhansk and Donetsk seceded, all of a sudden that population, which had voted 90% to be more friendly to Russia in the 2010 elections, if he just took them in to Russia, all of a sudden you've got a hostile Ukraine, because that's 4 million people that are no longer going to be in the vote. And he didn't want that. That's why he spent 8 years being duped by this bogus negotiation process, because that's what he really wanted. So no matter what, he's not going to get that. No matter what, it's going to be worse for Russia than it was before 2014, because what remains of Ukraine, which is still going to be, you know, 80% of it or more, is going to be pretty much just anti-Russia. So they can have this big country on their border that's anti-Russia, and he did not want that. He definitely did not want that. So he's, you know, no matter what, Russia is going to lose on this to some degree. Not along with it. And even though they've been able to overcome the sanctions have hurt. And Russians, you know, they're not doing the Russian ballet. It's been a very hugely negative thing for Russia. But, of course, the biggest loser is Ukraine by far and away. Right now, there's some estimates I've seen that put Ukraine's population down to just 20 million. The millions and millions of people that fled it. And here's something awful. Within 7 to 9 months of where the war starting, Ukraine had recruited 2 million men for the war. Now they're scrambling to field 200,000 men. Wow. That tells you what's going on. By the way, Russia's fought the war entirely volunteers. They have not had to use conscripts to fight the war. Now, they paid nice bonuses, but if the casualties were anything like the media seems to portray, if Russians are going out there and they're dying in a day, you couldn't pay enough money. The thing is, they've been fully volunteered, but even with the conscript gangs, you have videos of men jumping out of vans and dragging men off the street in Ukraine to fight this war. So Ukraine is running out of men to fight the war. So this war needs to end. And why Zelensky did it, who knows? This is a guy that was a comedian, a vulgar comedian, before he was put in power by the United States and other people that are anti-Russian. By the way, they supported him coming to power. And I will tell you, he used to do acts where he played the piano with his...
Run the air.
I know, but I'm just saying, he was a very vulgar guy. Yeah. This is not some genius guy. He runs around, and they've had multiple scandals. Billions, tens and tens of billions of dollars have gone missing. So I don't really know what's going on in his mind. but he's not been a good leader. He's not been a good military commander. He's done a lot of the actions they've taken have been for PR purposes. So he has sacrificed hundreds of thousands of casualties. For example, the Kursk incursion. You've heard of Kursk? Well, they went into Kursk to say, look, we have part of Russia now, and we took this much territory. There was no defense on it. They took and they held it, and they can say, look, and we want to use this as a negotiating bargain, you know, to give us power negotiating. And I looked at it thinking, yeah, but I'm going to guess that when we start to negotiate, that Russia's going to take it back. But until they start negotiating, Russia's going to let them stay there, because what they did is they created it's called a cauldron. What they did is they put their troops into an area where they're surrounded on three sides by Russian artillery and Russian air power. And since August, they've been pumping tens of thousands of men there just to keep a hold on there. And Russia was saying, well, if you want to stay here, surrounded by artillery and air power, we'll let you. That's, by the way, how Russia has demilitarized Ukraine. They demilitarized Ukraine by wiping out their men. The most brutal form, but Ukraine has participated. So predictably, once the negotiations started, Russia said, okay, that's enough. We don't want them talking about Kursk anymore. And they closed out Kursk. They immediately shut it down. And they pushed Ukraine out.
Okay, so a couple minutes left. Do you think Trump will succeed in ending this war?
I do think Trump will succeed. But one of the things he's working against is the public perception is so distorted on what's going on in Ukraine.
And the Democrats going and making promises to Zelensky behind his back.
And there's a lot of Republicans that are pushing what I consider to be a false narrative on this well. And there's still Republicans fighting the Cold War. Honestly, I've met some people that are great people, but they were Cold War warriors.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham would be one.
And I can think of military commanders, people that agree with them on everything else. But when it comes to Russia, they view it through the lens of, you know, the Cold War.
Yeah.
So it is not just Democrats, there's Republicans that have what I think is a inaccurate, distorted view of what's going on there. So whatever deal he does, people are to say, oh my gosh, he gave it to Putin. However, I do have hope, because I think Putin's smart enough that I believe he's taking territory right now. And this is just going out on a limb. I think Putin will be willing to give some of the territory back in order to give Trump something. It won't be all of it, but it will be something. But he's going to ask for something in return. And what he's going to be asking for is for Trump to take the U.S.-based sanctions away. So, yes, I do think Trump will get it done. I think there will be sanctions relief, and Trump may actually get some of the territory back for Ukraine.
Okay, well, we're out of time, Mike. I must confess I was surprised when you were mentioning these territories, and I had heard of them. But I realize that's my many years of playing Risk. We'll see you next week.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the law offices of Matthew Simone.